You betcha, I said. And that time I was watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Her smile faltered a fraction. You are Jessica Rabbit, right? I asked, all slinky and overblown and obvious. The smile vanished. Because I know I've seen you somewhere, and gosh, I'll be embarrassed if it turns out that you were the evil princess from Buck Rogers instead.
What? She said. Buck what?
I gave her my best forced smile. Hey, don't get me wrong. You do that ensemble justice, but you're trying too hard. I leaned a little closer and fake whispered, Laura does more for me just sitting in a chair than you did with your whole entrance. Madeline Wraith became as still and cold as a statue of a furious goddess, and the air temperature around us dropped several degrees. I suddenly sensed Thomas's presence beside me, and found my brother had leaned back against the railing on his elbows, his hands loose and relaxed. He was standing just a tiny bit closer to Madeline than I was. Madeline, he said in the precise same tone he'd used a moment before, go away before I beat you to death with my bare hands. Madeline jerked her head back as if Thomas had slapped her.
What?
You heard me, he said calmly. It isn't quite cricket as family squabbles go, I know, but I'm tired. I don't give a fuck what you or anyone else in the house thinks of me, and I don't respect you enough to play games with you, even if I was in the mood.
How dare you? Madeline snarled. How dare you threaten me? Laura will have the skin flayed from your body for this.
Oh, Thomas gave her a wintry smile. After what you projected at the wizard, he'd be well within his rights to burn you right down to your overpriced shoes.
I never!
And despite the orders handed down from the king, Thomas said, shaking his head. Laura's getting tired of cleaning up after you, Mad. She'd probably buy me a new set of steak knives if I found a way to make her life a bit less trying. Madeline laughed. It reminded me of glass breaking.
And do you think she loves you any better, cousin mine?
You refuse to appear with the house at meetings of the court and spend your time among the kine, grooming them and bringing shame upon your family. At least tell me you are planning to take the beasts to some sort of auction. You aren't capable of understanding why I do what I do, Thomas said.
Who would want to? She retorted. You're as much a degenerate as any of those fools in Scabus and Malvora.
Thomas's mouth ticked at the corner, but that was all the reaction he gave her. Go away, Madeline. Last warning. Two members of the oldest bloodlines in Wraith murdering each other, Madeline said, sneering. The White King could not tolerate such a divisive act, and you know it. She turned away from Thomas and walked toward Justine.
You're bluffing, she said over her shoulder. Besides, we haven't heard from our little pink rose yet.
Her voice sank to a throaty purr, and Justine quivered in place, seemingly unable to move as Madeline approached.
Pretty Justine, Madeline put a hand on Justine's shoulder and slid a single fingertip down the slope of one breast. I don't generally enjoy does as much as some, darling, but even I find the thought of taking you delicious.
You can't touch me, Justine stammered. She was breathing faster.
Not yet, Madeline said. But there's not enough will left in your pretty little head to control yourself for long.
Madeline stepped closer, sliding her hand along Justine's waist.
Some night, perhaps I'll come to you with some beautiful young buck and whisper pretty things to you until you're mad to be taken. And after he has made use of you, little doe, I'll take you in one big bite.
She licked her lips. I'll take you whole and make you scream how much you love it as it happened. Thomas broke a chair over Madeline's head. It was particularly impressive, given that all the chairs on the balcony were made of metal. It happened fast.
during an eye blink. One instant he was standing beside me, tightening with anger, and the next there were popped rivets zinging everywhere, and Madeline had been crushed to the floor of the balcony. The air went cold. Thomas dropped the ruined chair. Madeline bounced up from the floor and threw a blow at Thomas's jaw. He hunched and twisted, a boxer's defense, and took it on the shoulder with a grunt of pain. Then he seized her ankle and slammed her in a half circle, smashing a 36-24-36 dent into the drywall. Madeline cried out, and her limbs went loose. Thomas swung her in another arc that brought her crashing down onto the low coffee table between the couches. She lay there and let out a single choked gasp, her eyes unfocused. Without pausing, my brother snatched both chopsticks from Justine's hair, letting the white silver locks tumble down her back. Then, in two sharp, swift motions, he slammed the chopsticks through Madeline's wrists and into the table beneath them, pinning her like a butterfly to a card. "You're right, of course," he snarled. "Laura couldn't ignore one member of the family murdering another. It would make the king look weak." His hand closed over Madeline's face, and he pulled her head up toward his, making her arms strain at a painful angle. "I was bluffing." He shoved her back down against the table. "Of course," he said. "You are family. Families don't murder one another." He looked up at Justine and said, "They share." She met his eyes. A very small, very hard smile graced Justine's features. "You wanted to taste her," Thomas said, his fingers twining with Justine's rubber-clad ones. "Well, Madeline, be my guest." Justine leaned over and kissed Madeline Wraith's forehead, her silken silver hair falling to veil them both. The vampire screamed. The sound was lost in the pounding rhythm and flashing lights. Justine lifted her head a few seconds later and swept her hair slowly down the length of Madeline's form. The vampire writhed and screamed again while Thomas held her pinned to the table. Wherever Justine's hair glided over exposed flesh, the skin sizzled and burned, blackening in some places, forming blisters and welts in others. She left a trail of ruin down one of Madeline's legs and then rose together with Thomas, two bodies making one motion. Madeline Wraith's face was a ruin of burn marks, and the imprint of Justine's soft mouth was a perfect black brand on pale flesh in the center of her forehead. She lay on the table, still pinned by the chopsticks, and quivered in jerking little motions, gasping and breathless with the pain. Thomas and Justine walked, hand in hand, to the stairs leading down from our platform. I followed them. They passed beneath an air conditioning outlet, and a few strands of Justine's hair blew against Thomas's naked arm and chest. Small, bright lines of scarlet appeared. Thomas didn't flinch. I walked over to them and passed Justine a pair of pencils taken from my coat pocket. She took them with a nod of thanks and quickly bound up her hair again. I looked over my shoulder as she did. Madeline Wraith lay helpless and gasping, but her white eyes burned with hate. Thomas took his t-shirt from where he'd stowed it on a belt loop and put it back on. Then he slid his arms around Justine again and pulled her against his chest, holding her close. "Will you be all right?" he asked. Justine nodded, her eyes closed. "I'll call the house. Laura will send someone for her." "You leave her there and it's going to make trouble," I told him. He shrugged. "I couldn't get away with killing her, but our house has rather stern views on poaching." Something hard and hot entered his eyes. "Justine is mine." Madeline had to be shown that. She deserved it. Justine clung a little bit tighter to him. He returned the gesture. We all started down the stairs together, and I was glad to be leaving Zero. "Still," I said, "seeing her like that, I feel like maybe somebody went too far. I feel a little bit bad for her." Thomas arched an eyebrow and glanced back at me. "You do?" "Yeah," I said. I pursed my lips thoughtfully. Maybe I shouldn't have said that Jessica Rabbit thing. Chapter 10. The hot summer night outside Zero felt 10 degrees cooler and a million times cleaner than what we'd left behind us. Thomas turned sharply to the right and walked until he found a spot of shadow between streetlights and leaned one shoulder against the wall of the building. He bowed his head and stayed that way for a minute, then two. I waited. I didn't need to ask my brother what was wrong. The display of strength and power he'd used on Madeline had cost him energy. Energy that other vampires gained by feeding on victims, as Madeline had done to that poor sap inside. He wasn't upset by what had happened in Zero. He was hungry. Thomas's struggle against his own hunger was complicated, difficult, and maybe impossible to sustain. That never stopped him from trying, though. The rest of the Wraith family thought he was insane. But I got it. He walked back over to me a minute later, his cool features distant and untouchable as Antarctic mountains. He fell into pace beside me as we began walking down the street toward the lot where he'd parked his car. "Ask you a question?" I said. He nodded. "The White Court only get burned when they try to feed on someone touched by true love, right?"
"It isn't as simple as that," Thomas said quietly. "It's got to do with how much control the hunger has over you when you touch."
I grunted.
"But when they feed, the hunger's in control."
Thomas nodded slowly.
"So why'd Madeline try to feed on Justine? She had to know it would hurt her."
"Same reason I do," Thomas said. "She can't help it. It's reflex." I frowned.
"I don't get it."
He was quiet long enough to make me think he wasn't going to say anything before he finally spoke.
"Justine and I were together for years, and she means a lot to me. When I'm near her, I can't think about anything else but her. And when I touch her, everything in me wants to be nearer to her."
"Including your hunger," I said quietly.
He nodded. "We agree on that point, my demon and I, so I can't touch Justine without it being close to the surface, I suppose you would call it."
"And it gets burned," I said.
He nodded. "Madeline is the other end of the spectrum. She thinks she should get to feed on anyone she wants, anywhere, anytime. She doesn't see other people, she just sees food. Her hunger controls her completely." He smiled, a bitter little smile. "So for her, it's reflex, just like for me."
"You're different. For her, it's everyone," I said, "not only Justine."
He shrugged. "I don't care about everyone. I care about Justine."
"You're different," I said.
Thomas turned to face me, his expression rigid and cold.
"Shut up, Harry."
"But..."
His voice dropped to a low snarl.
"Shut up."
It was a little scary.
He stared hard at me for a while longer, then shook his head and exhaled slowly.
"I'll get the car. Wait here."
"Sure," I said.
He walked away on silent feet, his hands in his pockets, his head bowed. Every woman he passed, and some of the men, turned their heads to watch him go by. He ignored them.
I got a lot of looks, too. But that was because I was standing on a sidewalk near a lot of Chicago's night spots on a hot summer night, wearing a long leather coat and carrying a quarterstaff carved with mystic runes. Thomas's looks had all been subtitled "yum." My looks all said "weirdo." Tough to believe I was coming out ahead on that one. While I waited, my instincts nagged me again, a hairs on the back of my neck certainty that someone was focused on me. My instincts had been on a streak, so I paid attention to them, quietly preparing my shield bracelet as I turned my head in a slow, casual look up and down the street. I didn't spot anybody, but my vision sort of flickered as it passed over an alley across the street. I focused on that point intently for a moment, concentrating, and was able to make out a vaguely human shape there. Then the flicker was abruptly replaced with a form of Anastasia Lucio, who raised a hand and beckoned me.
Yikes.
I jaywalked over to her, timing my crossing in between the occasional passing car, and we took several steps back into the alley.
"Evening, Stacy," I said. She turned to me and, in a single motion, drew a curved saber from a sheath at her hip and produced a gun in her other hand. The tip of the blade menaced my face, and I had to jerk my head back, which put me off balance, and I wound up with my shoulders pressed up against a wall. Anastasia arched an eyebrow, her soft mouth set in a hard line. "I hope for your sake that you are the true Harry Dresden, only using that abomination of a nickname to make sure that I was the true Anastasia." She emphasized the word slightly, "Lucio." "Well, yes, Anastasia," I said, being careful not to move, "and by your reaction, I can tell that it really is you." She dropped the sword's point and lowered the gun. The tension faded from her body, and she put her hardware away. "Well, of course it's me. Who else would it be?" I shook my head. "I've had a bad shapeshifter night." She arched an eyebrow. Anastasia Lucia was the captain of the wardens of the White Council. She had a couple of centuries of experience. Her hair was brown and naturally curly, and her dimples made her smile absolutely adorable. "I've had those," she said, and put a hand on my arm. "Are you all right?" We stepped into each other and hugged. I hadn't realized how stiffly I'd been holding myself until I exhaled and relaxed a little. She felt slender and warm and strong in my arms. "So far, I'm not dead," I said. "I take it you used a tracking spell to run me down, since you don't seem to be worried about whether or not I'm me." She lifted her face to mine and planted a soft kiss on my mouth. "Honestly, Harry," she said, smiling, "who would pretend to be you?" "Someone who wanted to be kissed in dark alleys by seductive older women, apparently." Her smile widened for a second and then faded. "I thought I was going to have to break down the door and come in after you. What were you doing in that White Court cesspit?" "I didn't think I'd done anything to cause it, but we stepped out of each other's arms." "Looking for information," I said quietly. "Something's up, and someone's cut me out of the loop." Anastasia pressed her lips together and looked away. Her expression was closed, touched with anger. "Yes, orders." "Orders," I said. "From the Merlin, I guess." "From Ebenezer McCoy, actually." I grunted in surprise. McCoy had been my mentor when I was young. I respected him. "I get it," I said. "He was afraid that if I heard Morgan was on the run, I'd hat up and dish out some payback." She glanced up at me and then across the street at Zero. She shrugged without quite looking me in the face. "God knows you have enough cause to do so." "You agreed with him," I said. She looked up at me, her eyes a little wider. "If I did, then why am I standing here?" I frowned at her and scratched my head. "Okay, you got me on that one." "Besides," she said, "I was worried about you."
"Worried?"
She nodded. "Morgan's done something that is hiding him from even the senior counsel's abilities. I was afraid that he might come here."
"Poker face, don't fail me now."
"That's crazy," I said. "Why would he do that?" She squared her shoulders and faced me steadily.
"Maybe because he's innocent."
"And?"
"There are a number of people who have sought permission from the senior counsel to investigate and interrogate you under the presumption that you were the traitor who has been feeding information to the Red Court." She looked away again. "Morgan has been one of the most overt agitators." I took a deep breath.
"You're saying that Morgan knows he isn't the traitor, and he thinks it's me."
"And he might be moving toward you in an attempt to prove his own innocence, or, failing that,
kill me," I said quietly. "If he's going to go down, you think he might have decided to take out the real traitor before he gets the axe?"
And suddenly, I had to wonder if Morgan had shown up at my door for the reasons he'd given me. Anastasia had been Morgan's mentor when he was an apprentice. She'd known the man for the vast majority of his life, literally for generations. What if her judgment of him was better than mine? Sure, Morgan wasn't in any shape to kill me personally, but he wouldn't need to. All he had to do is call the wardens and tell them where he was. A lot of people in the council didn't like me much. I'd go down with Morgan, for giving aid and comfort to a traitor. I suddenly felt naive and vulnerable and maybe a little stupid. He was already in custody, I said. How did he get away? Lucio smiled faintly. We aren't sure. He thought of something we didn't, and he put 3 wardens in the hospital when he left. But you don't think he's guilty? She frowned for a moment and then said, I refuse to let fear turn me against the man I know and trust. But it doesn't matter what I think. There's enough evidence to kill him. What evidence? I asked. Other than finding him standing over Lafortier's corpse with a literal bloody knife in his hand? Yeah, I said. Other than that. She raked her fingers back through her curly hair. The information the Red Court has attained was exclusive to a very small pool of suspects, of which he was one. We have telephone records of him in frequent contact with a known operative of the Red Court. We also tracked down an offshore account belonging to him, in which several $1 million had recently been deposited. I snorted derisively. Yeah, that's him. Morgan the mercenary. Nothing but dollar signs in his eyes. I know, she said. That's what I mean about fear clouding people's judgment. We all know that the Red Court is going to come after us again. We know that if we don't eliminate the traitor, their first blow could be fatal. The Merlin is desperate. Join the club, I muttered. I rubbed at my eyes and sighed. She touched my arm again. I thought you had a right to know, she said. I'm sorry I wasn't able to get here sooner. I covered her hand with mine and pressed gently. Yeah, I said, thanks. You look awful. You sweet talker, you. She lifted her hand to touch my face. I've got a few hours before I need to be back on duty. I was thinking a bottle of wine and a massage might be in order. I only barely kept from groaning in pleasure at the very thought of one of Anastasia's massages. What she didn't know about inflicting merciless pleasure on a man's aching body hadn't been invented. But I sure as hell couldn't have her back over to the apartment. If she found out about Morgan, and if he truly intended to betray me, it would be frighteningly easy for her head to wind up on the floor next to Morgan's and mine. I can't, I told her. I've got to go to the hospital. She frowned. What happened? A skinwalker picked up my trail earlier tonight, when I was at Billy Borden's place. Kirby's dead. Andy's in the hospital. She sucked in a breath, wincing in empathy. Dio, Harry, I'm so sorry. I shrugged. I watched my vision blur and realized that I wasn't only making an excuse to keep her away from my place. Kirby and I hadn't been blood brothers or anything, but he was a friend, a regular part of my life. Emphasis on the was. Is there anything I can do? She asked. I shook my head. Then I said, actually, yeah. Very well. Find out whatever you can about skinwalkers. I'm going to kill this one. All right, she said. Meanwhile, I said, is there anything I can do for you? For me? She shook her head. But Morgan could use whatever help he can get. Yeah, I said, like I'm going to help Morgan. She lifted her hands. I know, but there's not much I can do. Everyone knows he was my apprentice. They're watching me. If I try to help him openly, they'll suspend me as captain of the wardens, at best. Don't you just love it when justice can't be bothered with petty concerns like fact? Harry, she said, what if he's innocent? I shrugged. The way I was all those years? I'm too busy admiring the karma to lend a hand to the bastard. Out on the street, Thomas's Jag cruised by the end of the alley, then pulled up to the curb and stopped. I glanced at the car and said, there's my ride. Anastasia arched an eyebrow at Thomas and his car. The vampire? He owed me a favor. Anastasia said. Her look at Thomas did not say yum. She looked more like someone who was trying to judge by how much she would have to lead a moving target. You sure? I nodded. The White King told him to play nice. He will. Until he doesn't, she said. Walkers can't be choosers, I said. The beetle died again? Why don't you get a different car? She asked. Because the blue beetle is my car. Anastasia smiled faintly up at me.
I wonder how you make something like that so endearing.
It's my natural good looks, I said. I could make athlete's foot endearing if I really had to.
She rolled her eyes, but was still smiling. I'll head back to Edinburgh and help coordinate the search. If there's anything I can do.
I nodded. Thank you. She put her hands on my cheeks.
I'm sorry about your friends. When this is over, we'll find some quiet spot and relax.
I turned my head to one side and kissed the pulse in her wrist, then gently clasped her hands with mine. Look, I'm not making any promises, but if I see something that might help Morgan, I'll let you know.
Thank you, she said quietly.
She stood up on her toes and kissed me goodbye. Then she turned and vanished into the shadows farther down the alley. I waited until she was gone to turn around and join my brother in the white Jag.
Damn, that girl is fit, Thomas drawled.
Where to?
Stop looking, I said. My place.
If Morgan was going to give me the shaft, I might as well find out now.
Chapter 11. Thomas stopped his Jag in front of the boarding house where my apartment was and said, I'll have my cell phone on me. Try to call me before things start exploding.
Maybe this time it'll be different. Maybe I'll work everything out through reason, diplomacy, dialogue, and mutual cooperation.
Thomas eyed me. I tried to look wounded.
It could happen.
He reached into his jeans pocket, pulled out a plain white business card with a phone number on it, and passed it to me.
Use this number. It's to a clone. I looked at him blankly.
It's a super-secret sneaky phone, he clarified. No one knows I have it, and if someone traces your calls and goes looking for me, they'll find someone else.
Oh, I said. Right.
You sure you don't want to just load Morgan up and go?
I shook my head.
Not until I give him the score. He sees me coming in with a vampire in tow. He's going to flip out. As in, try to kill us both.
I got out of the Jag, glanced at the house, and shook my head.
You stay alive for a dozen decades doing what Morgan does. Paranoia becomes a reflex.
Thomas grimaced.
Yeah. Give me an hour or so to get what you need. Call me when you've got him ready to go.
I glanced at the number, committed it to memory, and pocketed the card.
Thanks. I'll pay you back for the gear.
He rolled his eyes.
Shut up, Harry.
I snorted out of breath and nodded my head in thanks. We rapped knuckles and he pulled out onto the street and cruised out into the Chicago night.
I took a slow look around the familiar shapes of dark buildings where only a few lights still burned.
I'd lived in this neighborhood for years. You'd think I'd be confident about spotting anything out of the ordinary fairly quickly. But call me crazy, there were just too many players moving in this game, with God only knew what kinds of abilities to draw upon. I didn't spot anyone out there getting set to kill me to get to Morgan, but that didn't mean that they weren't there.
If that's not paranoid reflex, I muttered, I don't know what is.
I shivered and walked down the steps to my apartment. I disarmed the wards and reminded myself again that I really needed to do something about the deep divots in the steel security door. The last thing I needed was for old Mrs. Spunklecreef, my near-death landlady, to start asking me why my door looked like it had been shot a dozen times. I mean, I could always tell her, because it has been, but that isn't the sort of conversation one has with one's landlady if one wants to keep one's home. I opened the bullet-dented door, went inside, turned toward the bedroom door, and was faced with a bizarre tableau. Morgan was off the bed, sitting on the floor, with his back to it, his wounded leg stretched out in front of him. He looked awful, but his eyes were narrowed and glittered with suspicion. Sprawled in the bedroom doorway was my apprentice, Molly Carpenter. Molly was a tall young woman with a bunch of really well-arranged curves and shoulder-length hair that was, this month, dyed a brilliant shade of sapphire. She was wearing cut-off blue jeans and a white tank top, and her blue eyes looked exasperated. She was sprawling on the floor because Mouse was more or less lying on top of her. He wasn't letting his full weight rest on her because it probably would have smothered her, but it seemed obvious that she was not able to move.
Harry, Molly said. She started to say something else, but Mouse leaned into her a little, and suddenly all she could do was gasp for air.
Dresden, Morgan growled at about the same time. He shifted his weight as if to get up. Mouse turned his head to Morgan and gave him a steady look, his lips peeling back from his fangs. Morgan settled down.
"Hoo boy,"
I sighed and pushed the door shut, leaving the room in complete darkness. I locked the door, put the wards back up, and then muttered, "Flick'em bickus." I waved my hand as I spoke and sent a minor effort of will out into the room, and a half a dozen candles flickered to life. Mouse turned to me and gave me what I could have sworn was a reproachful look. Then he got up off of Molly, padded into the alcove that served as my kitchen, and deliberately yawned at me before flopping down on the floor to sleep. The meaning was clear. "Now it's your problem." "Ah," I said, glancing from Mouse to my apprentice to my guest. What happened here, exactly?"
"The warlock tried to sneak up on me while I slept," Morgan spat.
Molly quickly stood up and scowled at Morgan, her hands clenched into fists.
"Oh, that's ridiculous!"
"Then explain what you're doing here this late at night," Morgan said. "What possible reason could you have to show up here now?"
"I'm making concentration-supporting potions," she said from between clenched teeth, in a tone that suggested she'd repeated herself about 100 times already. "The jasmine has to go in at night. Tell him, Harry."
Crap. In all the excitement, I'd forgotten that the grasshopper was scheduled to show up and pull an all-nighter. I said,
"What I meant to ask was, how is it that Mouse came to be sitting on you both?"
"The warlock summoned up her will and prepared to attack me," Morgan said frostily. "The dog intervened."
Molly rolled her eyes and glared at him.
"Oh, please. You are such an asshole."
The air in the room seemed to tighten a little as power gathered around the young woman.
"Molly," I said gently.
She glanced over at me, scowling.
"What?"
I cleared my throat and gestured at her with one hand. She blinked for a second, then seemed to catch on. She closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and exhaled it slowly. As she did, the ominous sense of stormy energy faded. Molly ducked her head a little, her cheeks flushing.
"Sorry, but it wasn't like that."
Morgan snorted. I ignored him.
"Go on," I told Molly. "Talk." "I just got so angry," Molly said. "He made me so upset. I couldn't help it."
She gestured to Mouse.
"And then he just flattened me. And he wouldn't let me up. And he wouldn't let Morgan move either."
"Seems to me that the dog had better sense than you," I said. I glanced up at Morgan. "Either of you. You're supposed to stay still. You want to kill yourself?"
"It was a reaction to her approach," Morgan said calmly. "I survived it."
I shook my head.
"And you," I said to Molly, "how many months have we spent working on your emotional control?"
I know, she said. "It's never good to use magic in anger. I know, Harry."
"You'd better know it," I said quietly. "If it's so easy to get a rise out of you that one bitter old washed-up warden can blow your O-ring, the first reactionary Goomba to come along looking for an excuse to take you out is going to put you in a casket, claim it was self-defense, and get away with it."
Morgan bared his teeth in an expression only remotely resembling a smile.
"You'd know all about that, Dresden, wouldn't you?"
"You son of a bitch!" Molly snarled and whirled toward Morgan, seizing a candlestick and hefting it like a club. The candle on it tumbled to the floor.
Morgan sat perfectly still with that same gruesome smile on his face, never flinching.
I lurched forward and grabbed Molly's arm on her backswing, an instant before she would have brought the heavy candlestick crashing down on Morgan's skull. Molly was strong for a woman, and I had to make a pretty serious effort to hold her back, my fingers digging into her wrist, while I snagged her around the waist with my other arm and bodily hauled her away from Morgan.
"No," I demanded. "Damn it, Molly, no!"
I actually had to lift her feet off the ground to turn her away from the bedroom. I tightened my grip on her wrist and said,
"Drop the candlestick, Molly, now."
She let out a sound full of anger and laced with a little pain, and the heavy candlestick dropped to the floor, making a dull thud as it hit the rug-covered concrete. The air around her was alive with power, buzzing against my skin like a thousand tiny sparks of static electricity in a dry winter.
"He can't talk to you like that," Molly snarled.
"Think," I told her, my voice hard but measured. "Remember the lessons. They're just words, Molly. Look for the thought behind them. He set you up for this reaction. You're allowing him to make you embarrass me." Molly opened her mouth on an angry retort, then forced her mouth closed and turned her face away from me. She remained rigidly tense, and after a fuming half minute, she said, her voice more calm, "I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry," I replied as gently as I could. "Be disciplined. You can't afford to let them rattle you. Not ever."
She took another deep breath, exhaled, and then I felt her begin to ease down, relaxing her mental grasp on the power she'd instinctively prepared.
"Okay," she said. "Okay, Harry."
I let her go, slowly. She began to rub at her right wrist with her other hand. I winced a little on her behalf. I thought I'd left bruises on her skin.
"Do me a favor," I said. "Take Mouse and grab the mail."
"I'm fine. I don't need..." she began. Then she stopped herself, shook her head, and looked at Mouse. The big dog heaved himself up, walked over to the basket next to the door, grasped his leather lead in his jaws, and dragged it out. Then he looked up at Molly, his head cocked to one side, his tail wagging hopefully. Molly let out a rueful little laugh and knelt down to hug the big dog. She clipped his lead onto his collar, and the two of them left. I turned and eyed the candle. It had spilled hot wax onto a genuine Navajo rug on the floor, but it hadn't set anything on fire. I bent down and picked up the candle, then started trying to clean up the spilled wax as best I could.
"Why?" I asked in a hard voice.
"It's one way to take a measure of a man," he said, looking at his students.
"You didn't look," I said. "You needled her until she broke."
"She's a self-proclaimed warlock, Dresden," he replied. "Guilty of one of the most hideous and self-destructive crimes a wizard can commit. Is there some reason she shouldn't be tested?"
"What you did was cruel," I said.
"Was it?" Morgan asked. "There are others she's going to meet one day who will be even less gracious. Are you preparing her to deal with those people?"
I glared at him. His gaze never wavered.
"You aren't doing her any favors by going easy on her, Dresden," he said more quietly. "You aren't preparing her for exams. She doesn't receive a bad mark if she fails." I was quiet for a minute. Then I asked, "Did you learn shields as an apprentice?"
"Of course, one of my earliest lessons."
"How did your master teach you?"
"She threw stones at me," he said.
I grunted, without looking at him.
"Pain is an excellent motivator," he said. "And it teaches one to control one's emotions at the same time." He tilted his head. "Why do you ask?"
"No reason," I told him. "She could have broken your head open, you know." He gave me that same unsettling smile.
"You wouldn't have let her."
Molly came back into the apartment, carrying a handful of mail, including one of those stupid Circuit City flyers that they just won't stop sending me. She shut the door, put the wards back up, and took Mouse's lead off. The big dog went over to the kitchen and flopped down. Molly put the mail on the coffee table, gave Morgan a level, pensive look, and then nodded at him.
"So, what's he doing here, boss?"
I stared at Molly for a moment and then at Morgan.
"What do you think?" I asked him.
He shrugged a shoulder.
"She already knows enough to implicate her. Besides, Dresden, if you go down with me, there's no one left to take responsibility for her. Her sentence will not remain suspended."
I ground my teeth together. Molly had made a couple of bad choices a few years back and violated one of the laws of magic in doing so. The White Council takes a harsh view of such things. Their reactions start with beheadings and become progressively less tolerant. I'd staked my own life on the belief that Molly wasn't rotten to the core and that I could rehabilitate her. When I did it, I'd known that I was risking my own well-being. If Molly backslid, I'd bear the responsibility for it and get a death sentence about 20 seconds after she did.
I hadn't really considered that it would also work the other way around. Say, for a minute, that it was Morgan's intention to get caught and take me down with him. It also meant that Molly would take a fall. He'd get rid of both of the council's former warlocks with the same move. Two birds, one stone. Well, crap. Okay, I sighed. I guess you're in. I am? Molly looked at me with widening eyes. In what? I told her. Chapter 12. I don't like it, Morgan growled as I pushed the wheelchair over the gravel toward the street and the van Thomas had rented. Gee, there's a shock, I said. Morgan was a lot to push around, even with the help of the chair. You upset with how I operate? He's a vampire, Morgan said. He can't be trusted. I can hear you, Thomas said from the driver's seat of the van. I know that vampire, Morgan said without raising his voice. He eyed me again. He owes me a favor, I said, from that coup attempt in the White Court. Morgan glowered at me. You're lying, he said. For all you know, it's true. No, it isn't, he said flatly. You're lying to me. Well, yes. He looked from me to the van. You trust him. To a degree, I said. Idiot, he said, though he sounded like his heart wasn't in it. Even when a White Court vampire is sincere, you can't trust it. Sooner or later, its demon takes control, and then you're nothing but food. It's what they are. I felt a little surge of anger and clubbed it down before I could make my mouth start moving. You came to me, remember? You don't like how I'm helping you? Feel free to roll yourself right out of my life. Morgan gave me a disgusted look, folded his arms, and shut his mouth. Thomas turned on the hazard lights as the van idled on the street, and he came around and opened up the side door. He turned to Morgan and picked up the wheelchair the wounded warden sat in with about as much effort as I'd used to move a sack of groceries from the cart into my car's trunk. Thomas put the wheelchair carefully into the van while Morgan held the IV bag steady on its little metal pole clamped to the chair's arm. I had to give Morgan a grudging moment of admiration. He was one tough son of a bitch. Obviously in agony, obviously exhausted, obviously operating in the shambles of his own shattered pride, he was still stubborn enough to be paranoid and annoying. If he wasn't aiming it all at me, I probably would have admired him even more. Thomas slid the door shut on Morgan, rolled his eyes at me, and got back into the driver's seat. Molly came hurrying up, carrying a pair of backpacks, holding one end of Mouse's leash. I held out my hand, and she tossed me the black nylon pack. It was my trouble kit. Among other things, it contained food, water, a medical kit, survival blankets, chemical light sticks, duct tape, two changes of clothing, a multi-tool, $200 in cash, my passport, and a couple of favorite paperbacks. I always kept the trouble kit ready and available in case I need to move out in a hurry. It had everything I would need to survive about 90% of the planet's environments for at least a couple of days. Molly, acting on her own initiative, had begun putting her own trouble kit together the same day she learned about mine, except that her backpack was pink. "You sure about this?" I asked her, pitching my voice low enough that Morgan wouldn't hear. She nodded. "He can't stay there alone. You can't stay with him. Neither can Thomas." I grunted. "Do I need to search your bag for candlesticks?" She gave me a chagrined shake of her head. "Don't feel too bad, kid," I told her. "He had a couple of hours to work you up to that. And he's the guy who nearly cut your head off during that mess around SplatterCon." "It wasn't that," she said quietly. "It's what he said to you. What he's done to you." I put my hand on her arm and squeezed gently. She smiled faintly at me. "I've never really felt hate before. Not like that." "Your emotions got the better of you, that's all." "But it isn't," she insisted, folding her arms against her stomach, her shoulders hunching a little. "Harry, I've seen you all but kill yourself to help people who were in trouble, but for Morgan, that doesn't matter. You're just this thing that did something wrong once, and you'll never, ever be anything else." "Aha." Kid, I said quietly, maybe you should think about who you were really angry with back there.
What do you mean?
I shrugged. I mean, there's a reason you snapped when he started in on me. Maybe the fact that he was being Morgan just happened to be coincidental. She blinked her eyes several times, but not fast enough to stop one tear. You did a bad thing once, I said. It doesn't make you a monster. Two more tears fell.
What if it does?
She wiped at her cheeks with a brusque, frustrated motion.
What if it does, Harry?
I nodded. Because if Morgan's right, and I'm just a ticking time bomb, and I'm trying to rehabilitate you, you haven't got a chance in hell. I get it. She pressed her lips together, and it made her words sound stiff. Just before Mouse knocked me down, I wanted to do things to Morgan, to his mind, to make him act differently. I was so angry, and it felt right. Feeling something and acting on it are two different things. She shook her head. But who would want to do that, Harry? What kind of monster would feel that? I slung the pack over one shoulder so that I could put my hands on either side of her face and turn her eyes to mine. Her tears made them very blue. The human kind, Molly. You are a good person. Don't let anyone take that away from you. Not even yourself. She didn't even try to stop the tears. Her lip quivered. Her eyes were wide and her cheeks were fever warm under my fingers.
Are you sure?
Yes. She bowed her head and her shoulders shook. I leaned down to rest my forehead against hers. We stayed that way for a minute. You're okay, I told her quietly. You aren't a monster. You're gonna be all right, Grasshopper. A series of sharp rapping sounds interrupted us. I looked over my shoulder and found Morgan glowering at me. He held up a pocket watch, an honest-to-God gold pocket watch, and jabbed a forefinger at it impatiently.
Jerk, Molly mumbled, sniffling. Big, fat, grumpy jerk.
Yes, but he has a point. Tick-tock. She swiped a hand at her nose and collected herself.
Okay, she said. Let's go.
The storage rental facility was located a couple of blocks from Deerfield Square in a fairly upscale suburban neighborhood north of Chicago proper. Most of the buildings nearby were residential, and it was tough to go more than a quarter of an hour without spotting a patrol car. I picked it as the spot for my bolt hole for one reason. Shady characters would stand out against the upper-middle-class background like mustard stains under a blacklight. Granted, it would probably work even better if I wasn't one of them. I used my key at the security gate, and Thomas pulled the van around to my unit, a storage unit the size of a two-car garage. I unlocked the steel door and rolled it up while Thomas got Morgan out of the van. Molly followed, and when I beckoned, she wheeled Morgan into the storage space. Mouse got down out of the van and followed us. I rolled the door back down and called Wizard Light to the amulet I held up in my right hand until its blue-white glow filled the unit. The interior of the place was mostly empty. There was a camp cot, complete with sleeping bag and pillow, placed more or less in the middle of the room, along with a footlocker I had filled with food, bottled water, candles, and supplies. A second footlocker sat next to the first one, and was filled with hardware and magical gear, a backup blasting rod, and all manner of useful little items one could use to accomplish a surprisingly broad spectrum of thaumaturgic workings. A camp toilet with a couple of jugs of cleaning liquid sat on the opposite side of the cot. The floor, the walls, and the ceiling were covered in sigils, runes, and magical formulae. They weren't proper wards, like the ones I had on my home, but they worked on the same principles. Without a threshold to build them upon, no single one of the formulae was particularly powerful, but there were lots of them. They began to gleam with a silvery glow in the light coming from my amulet. Wow, Molly said, staring slowly around her. What is this place, Harry? Bolt hole I set up last year, in case I needed someplace quiet where I wouldn't get much company. Morgan was looking too, though his face was pale and drawn with pain. He swept his eyes around and said, What's the mix? Concealment and avoidance, mostly, I replied. Plus a Faraday cage.
Morgan nodded, glancing around.
It looks adequate.
What's that mean? Molly asked me. A Faraday what?
It's what they call it when you shield equipment from electromagnetic pulses, I told her. You build a cage of conductive material around the thing you want to protect, and if a pulse sweeps over it, the energy is channeled into the earth.
Like a lightning rod, Molly said.
Pretty much, I said. Only instead of electricity, this is built to stop hostile magic.
Once, Morgan corrected me primly. I grunted.
Without a threshold to work with, there's only so much you can do.
The idea is to protect you from a surprise assault, long enough for you to go out the back door and run.
Molly glanced at the back of the storage unit and said, There's no door there, Harry. That's a wall. It's kind of the opposite of a door.
Morgan nodded his head at the back corner of the space, where a large rectangular area on the floor was clear of any runes or other markings.
There, he said. Where's it come out?
About 3 long steps from one of the marked trails the Council has right of passage on in Unseelie territory, I said. I nodded at a cardboard box sitting in the rectangle.
It's cold there. There are a couple of coats in the box.
A passage to the Never Never, Molly breathed. I hadn't thought of that.
Hopefully whoever was coming after me wouldn't either, I said.
Morgan eyed me.
One can't help noting, he said, that this place seems ideally suited to hiding and sheltering a fugitive from the wardens.
Huh, I said. Now that you mention it, yeah. Yeah, it does seem kind of friendly to that sort of purpose.
I gave Morgan an innocent look.
Just an odd coincidence, I'm sure, since I happen to be one of those paranoid lunatics myself.
Morgan glowered.
You came to me for a reason, Chuckles, I said. Besides, I wasn't thinking about the wardens nearly so much as I was...
I shook my head and shut my mouth.
As who, Harry? Molly asked.
I don't know who they are, I said. But they've been involved in several things lately. The Dark Hallow, Arctis Tor, the White Court coup. They're way too handy with magic. I've been calling them the Black Council.
There is no Black Council, Morgan snapped, with a speed that could only have been born of reflex.
Molly and I traded a look.
Morgan let out an impatient breath. Any actions that may have been taken are the work of isolated renegades, he said. There is no organized conspiracy against the White Council.
Uh-huh, I said. Gosh, I'd have thought you'd be right on board with the conspiracy thing.
The Council is not divided, he said, his voice as hard and cold as I had ever heard it. Because the moment we turn upon one another, we're finished. There is no Black Council, Dresden.
I lifted both eyebrows. From my perspective, the Council's been turning on me for most of my life, I said. And I'm a member. I have a robe and everything.
You, Morgan spat, are...
He almost seemed to be choking on something before he blew out a breath and finished.
Vastly irritating.
I beamed at him. That's the Merlin's line, isn't it? I said. There is no conspiracy against the Council.
It is the position of the entire Senior Council, Morgan shot back.
Okay, smart guy, I said. Explain what happened to you.
He glowered again, only with more purple.
I nodded sagely, then turned to Molly.
This place should protect you from most tracking spells, I said, and the avoidance wards should keep anyone from wandering by or asking any questions.
Morgan made a growling noise.
Suggestions, not compulsions, I said, rolling my eyes. They're in common usage and you know it.
What do I do if someone does come? She asked.
Veil and run, I said.
She shook her head.
I don't know how to open a way to the Never Never, Harry. You haven't shown me yet.
I can show her, Morgan said. Both of us stopped and blinked at him.
He was very still for a second and then said,
I can do it. If she watches, maybe she'll learn something.
He glared at me.
But doors open both ways, Dresden. What if something comes in through it?
Mouse went over to the open space and settled down about 6 inches away from it.
He sighed once, shifted his weight a bit, and went to sleep again, though his ears twitched at every noise. I went to the first footlocker and opened it, took out a boxed fruit drink and passed it to him. "Your blood sugar's getting low. It's making you grumpy. But if you do get an unexpected visitor from the other side..." I went to the second locker, opened it, and drew out a pump-action shotgun, its barrel cut to well below the minimum legal length. I checked it and passed the weapon to Molly. "It's loaded with a mix of steel shot and rock salt. Between that and Mouse, it should discourage anything that comes through." "Right," Molly said. She checked the weapon's chamber and then worked the pump, chambering a shell. She double-checked the safety and then nodded at me.
"You taught her guns," Morgan said, "but not how to open passages to the never-never."
"There's enough trouble right here in the real world," I said.
Morgan grunted.
"True enough. Where are you going?"
"Only one place I can go,"
he nodded.
"Edinburgh."
I turned toward the door and opened it. I looked from Morgan with his juice box to Molly with her shotgun.
"You two play nice."
Chapter 13. Wizards and technology don't get on so well, and that makes travel sort of complicated. Some wizards seem to be more of a bad influence on technology than others, and if any of them were harder on machinery than me, I hadn't met them yet. I've been on a jet a couple of times and had one bad experience, just one. After the plane's computers and guidance system went bad, and we had to make an emergency landing on a tiny commercial airfield, I wasn't eager to repeat the experience. Buses were better, especially if you sat toward the back, but even they had problems. I hadn't been on a bus trip longer than 300 or 400 miles without winding up broken down next to the highway in the middle of nowhere. Cars could work out, especially if they were fairly old models. The fewer electronics involved, the better. Even those machines, though, tended to provide you with chronic problems. I'd never owned a car that ran more than maybe 9 days in 10, and most of them were worse than that. Trains and ships were the ideal, especially if you could keep yourself a good way from the engines. Most wizards, when they traveled, stuck with ships and trains. Either that or they cheated, like I was about to do. Back at the beginning of the war with the vampire courts, the White Council, with the help of a certain wizard private investigator from Chicago, who shall remain nameless, negotiated the use of ways through the near reaches of the Never-Never, controlled by the Unseelie Court. The Never-Never, the world of ghosts and spirits and fantastic beings of every description, exists alongside our own mortal reality, but it isn't the same shape. That meant that in places, the mortal world touched upon the Never-Never at two points that could be very close together, while in the mortal realm, they were very far apart. In short, use of the ways meant that anyone who could open a path between worlds could use a major shortcut. In this case, it meant I could make the trip from Chicago, Illinois, to Edinburgh, Scotland, in about half an hour. The closest entry point to where I wanted to go in the Never-Never was a dark alley behind a building that had once been used for meat packing. A lot of things had died in that building, not all of them cleanly, and not all of them cows. There's a dark sense of finality to the place, a sort of ephemeral quality of dread that hangs so lightly on the air that the unobservant might not notice it at all. In the middle of the alley, a concrete staircase led down to a door that was held shut with both boards and chains. Talk about overkill. I walked down the steps to the bottom of the stairs, closed my eyes for a moment, and extended my otherworldly senses, not toward the door, but toward the section of concrete beside it. I could feel the thinness of the world there, where energy pulsed and hummed just beneath the seemingly rigid surface of reality. It was a hot night in Chicago, but it wouldn't be on the ways. I wore a long-sleeved shirt and jeans and a couple of pairs of socks beneath my hiking shoes. My heavy leather duster had me sweating. I gathered up my will, reached out my hand, and with a whisper of "Aperturum," I opened a way between worlds. Honestly, it sounds quite a bit more dramatic than it looks. The surface of the concrete wall rippled with a quick flickering of color and began to put out a soft glow. I took a deep breath, gripped my staff in both hands, and stepped directly forward into the concrete. My flesh passed through what should have been stone, and I emerged in a dark wood that lay covered in frost and a thin layer of snow. At least this time the ground in Chicago had been more or less level with the ground in the Never-Never. Last time I'd had a 3-inch drop I hadn't expected, and I'd fallen on my ass into the snow. No harm done, I suppose, but this part of the Never Never was just chock full of things you did not want to think.